With the trail slippery from the monsoon rain, Jonathan Wright, Ong Furba, and I entered the Topten Koling Monastery in a cul-de-sac valley 26 miles from Mount Everest. The three of us were on a mission to seek a blessing from the High Abbot, Lama Tuche Rinpoche. The blessing wasn't just for us, but for our American Bicentennial Everest expedition. I was the youngest climber on a team hoping to become what back then would have been only the second American expedition to climb Everest. Jonathan was a cameraman on the film crew making a one-hour special for television, and Ong, who spoke conversational English, was the climbing leader of our team of Sherpas. We had left the rest of the expedition earlier that morning in the camp we had set up the previous afternoon at the end of that day's stage of the approach march. The team included my climbing partner, Chris Chandler. Chris and I had started climbing together 3 years earlier, spending a season in the Peruvian Andes, where we succeeded in making a new route on a major peak in the Cordillera Blanca. Chris had started as my climbing mentor, but I learned quickly, and now, on a rope team, we were equals. The American Bicentennial Everest Expedition was one of the last of the old-school expeditions in the style of the first British teams that attempted Everest in the 1920s and 30s. We were approaching the mountain the traditional way, beginning at a trailhead a two-hour drive outside of Kathmandu. From there, the trek to base camp was 170 miles and would take a month. The size of the expedition was old school as well, 12 climbers, 44 Sherpas, and a little over 600 porters hired from the lowland tribes. 600 porters. In Peru, we had hired only a few burros and an arriero to wrangle the animals to our base camps. The Everest expedition seemed to have expanded under its own compounding inertia. It had an unusual genesis, with three friends, all classmates at Harvard Law School, who, after graduation, pledged to fulfill their passion for adventure by getting together every year or two for a trip. They each had gone on to successful careers, one in real estate, one in international law, and one in the State Department, and they had held true to their pledge, skiing across Ellesmere Island, rafting the interior of Borneo, and climbing the Karsinst Pyramid, the highest peak in New Guinea. Back in the 1970s, when China was closed and Nepal hadn't opened to the hordes of guided climbers, the queue for an Everest permit was more than 10 years. But the one friend who worked in the State Department got wind from a colleague in the U.S. Embassy in Kathmandu that a French team had failed to raise funds and their permit was available. He got the permit through his diplomatic connections, but to climb Everest, the friends knew they would need additional climbers and ones with advanced mountaineering skills. They went to the annual meeting of the American Alpine Club, hoping to meet expedition climbers. Standing in line at the buffet, they introduced themselves to a guy with long blonde hair who looked to be in good shape. "I'm Chris Chandler. Nice to meet you." By the time they got to the food, they had invited Chris to join their expedition, and Chris had recommended me. I was living in Malibu with some surfer friends and had been accepted into a PhD program in cultural geography at UC Berkeley that was scheduled to start in a month. I decided that I wanted to be a professor. To get into a good school, my strategy had been first to enroll at a university in Peru in cultural anthropology with courses that included fieldwork in the Andes. When my courses concluded, I had stayed in Peru, where I met climbers, including Chris, who took me under their wing and initiated my apprenticeship in high-altitude mountaineering. The strategy worked, and I had been accepted into one of the best schools in the world. Then I got the call from Chris.